So let your colors run tonight. We're painting in the dark. Let your colors run tonight. The colors of your heart.
Hello and welcome to the Catchy Lefty podcast. My name is Patrick Engel, and today we're going to talk a little bit about the themes between Christmastide and Epiphany. We're going to talk about the scripture passage for Christmastide, which for Christmastide number one is 1 Samuel chapter 2, 18 through 20, and a tag on of verse 26. Today I'm joined by Chris Patton and JR, I can't pronounce your last name, Stranger, right? Is that what it means?
Yeah, Spanish for weird.
For Sarah. Okay, perfect. Right. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. There's no snow up here in Ohio yet, so we're doing pretty well.
And JR?
I'm also doing well. I'm in Texas, so we don't really believe in snow. Before the show, we were talking a little bit about how we're approaching these. You know, these, we have two Sundays of Christmas, and it's always a little strange. As you know, it's the end of the calendar year and the beginning of the next calendar year. So you've got like New Year's kind of crowding in on Christmas, the lectionary themes. So I was curious to hear what you guys are doing as far as these two Sundays. We are sticking with the what to expect when we're expecting theme. And so we're going to be focusing more on, since we've been anticipating, now that we're at the end of this journey of expectation, what can we learn from living in the moment of fulfillment, or living in the moment of the end of the anticipation, you know, before we move into the next series. Chris, what are you guys doing?
We're going to continue that theme as well and try to tie in. We try to focus very clearly on Advent as opposed to Christmas as far as the seasons go. And so this gives us a couple weeks to really celebrate the season of Christmas, but can kind of continue that theme. Okay, now that Advent has passed, what does it look like to celebrate Christmas each year, especially with these texts?
Nice. And Patrick, you're doing something completely different, right?
Right, we're going rogue, and we're going to start the Fear and Desire series that will lead right into Epiphany for us. I mean, like everybody here who I think uses the lectionary, we try to emphasize Advent and discuss how it's different than the Christmas season, and so. What I'm really kind of focusing on for our church is that as we are done with Advent and with that season of expecting, and then Christmas shows up, well, this is what starts to happen when the Savior appears or even reappears. And so how do we respond to the revelation of Jesus now in the season of Christmas and then into the season of Epiphany? So we're jumping straight into the whole theme of fear and desire and talking. And also I think that works really well just for our current kind of country's context here in America. And then just for my own church people and kind of where they're at in their individual lives. How do we deal with fear and desire in light of the proclamation of the good news that God has come and that God is with us? And so that's what we're doing starting in Christmas. Plus, I just like to keep things a little strange anyway. So, I mean, if you can mess people up and they're like, why are we talking about this and it's Christmas? Shouldn't we be having like reading about little baby Jesus? You know, it just makes it better.
I like it. So this is maybe a little bit off topic as well, because this is technically for the Sunday after Christmas. But what do you guys do for Christmas Eve and Christmas Day as far as worship gatherings?
Well, we do a candlelight service. Really, we start it really early. Like we started at like 5 on Christmas Eve, and then we come in and we light our Advent candles, and we do a collective reading together about the second coming. And then we sing that this is the time where we sing both Advent songs and kind of Christmas songs. And then we go on our merry way.
I like that merry way. Chris, what about you guys?
Yeah, we have in our part of the world, or at least for our church, Christmas Eve is kind of like big family worship time. And so there's lots of families there who don't usually come to church. So you
get an altar call, right?
Yeah, right. In the sense that we receive communion, yes, we give an altar call.
Oh, way to Jesus juke that joke.
So we kind of go all out with the Christmas, and Christmas Eve is a difficult service because of the family dynamics that are going on, and it always feels like it's a struggle to make it about Jesus and not about getting together with family and all of the warm, fuzzy feelings that go along with that. So we try to focus the service. It's probably a lot less laid back than some other places, but I think we try to do that to sort of counteract that cultural issue through which we struggle up here.
We do a Christmas Eve, and we tell people it's going to be, you know, 45 minutes, which is shorter than our normal worship gatherings. And we do the same thing. Like, we don't try to do any kind of childcare or separate kids church. We have everyone together. So we design everything to be really modular. Like, nothing's longer than about 5 or 7 minutes. We have some videos that we incorporate to do some of the Christmas storytelling and things like that. And then we end with candlelight and singing, I think, Joy to the World, as like Silent Night, of course, then into the Joy to the World, and everyone goes home. We do it pretty early in the night. I think we start at 5:30, so that, again, people with families are going to go home and do their you know, stuff for the little kids and all that. We're talking about doing a midnight mass kind of a thing, where we would basically start it at 11 or 11:15 and end at midnight. But we've never done anything like that before. We don't know how well attended it would be. So we're kind of putting out some feelers and exploring the possibility of doing that as well.
That'd be cool. Let me know how it goes.
Will do. So the text for this week, we're still in the Old Testament for these next 2 weeks, and it's 1 Samuel 2:18-20, and then verse 26, which when I saw that it was going to be this text, I was really excited, because I've been wanting to preach on this particular passage for quite a while. So I was excited to finally get a chance to do that.
Why exactly did you want to preach on this text?
Because one of the most important books in my own relationship with the Bible that I ever read was a book called The Children of Israel, Reading the Bible for the Sake of Our Children, by a woman named Dana Fuel, who teaches at, I believe, Drew University out in New Jersey. And the way she told the story of Hannah and the meaning that she poured specifically into the verse that seems almost like a throwaway verse about her making a coat for Samuel has just really struck me and stuck with me. And so I was anticipating a day when I would get to tackle that in a sermon. And so when I saw that this was the lectionary text, I was really excited.
Cool. So how did she approach just kind of that whole idea of Hannah making a robe for Samuel?
Yeah, so
that's kind of like something easy to kind of skim over, I would think, in this passage.
Absolutely. Should we read it real quick, since it's so short? Just
yeah, do that, let's on do here? It. we haven't, I don't think so, but I mean, hey, we can do it.
Okay, so I'll read it. This is 18, 19, and 20, and then verse 26. So it says, "But Samuel, though he was only a boy, served the Lord. He wore a linen garment like that of a priest. Each year his mother made a small coat, or I think the actual Hebrew is a robe, for him, and brought it to him when she came with her husband for the sacrifice. Before they returned home, Eli would bless Elkanah and his wife, saying, 'May the Lord give you other children to take the place of the one she gave to the Lord.'" And then it says, "Meanwhile, the boy Samuel grew taller and grew in favor with the Lord and with the people." For Fuel, she read the story of Hannah and the story of Hannah giving Samuel to the temple as an act of defiance and as an act of faith that God, a God who had been strangely silent at the temple at Shiloh for a long time, if you go back and read through Judges, was finally acting. And the proof of that was Samuel himself, because Hannah had a closed womb. And when she prays to God, God acts and opens her womb. And so for her, Samuel was a living embodiment of God's commitment to act in the world. And so she takes Hannah's gift of Samuel to the temple and then her singing the song that Mary's Magnificat is based on as basically the idea that for Hannah, giving Samuel to the temple was an act of faith, and that she believed that God would use Samuel to bring about this sort of justice that she sings about in the song. Not like she was just sad and sang a song on her way home. And so for her, the making of the coat was Hannah's way of continuing to care for Samuel at a distance. And she used she used the metaphor of a robe or a coat is a way of extending your arms around someone even when you're not in their presence.
I also like the idea with that. With that robe, that it was something that he wore with his kind of religious garment as well.
Yeah.
Like he wore it underneath his almost, I guess, as a continuing act of defiance to the religious system of her day.
Yeah.
Which I think we could probably get into that later once you finish talking about the robe, because I have some thoughts on that.
Well, that was it, right? I mean, it's like if you read after, like the verses between 20 and 26, you see that Eli's sons are exploiting their power and abusing people, and the temple at Shiloh is a relatively terrible place. You know, it's and I think yeah. Fuel makes the observation in her text, in her book, that it's surprising that anyone would have thought that a prayer you offered at Shiloh would be heard.
Right, yeah.
Or that a god that people at Shiloh worshipped was worth worshiping or worth was praying. Worth,
right. And I think that's the bigger issue that's taken place is that this is early on in 1 Samuel. This is still part of the Exodus story. Like I think we tend to, a lot of people who are used to reading the Old Testament or maybe even preaching on the Old Testament tend to associate Samuel with like the monarchy, with Saul and David. But this, I think, should be better associated with Joshua and Judges, like the early entrance into the promised land and the issues that are going.
He's the judge, right? I mean, he doesn't know that he's the last judge, but he is the last judge. Like he is a judge.
Right. And this is like the epilogue of the story of Exodus. So there's the idea that Exodus is this profound, deep revelation that there is a God who cares for the slaves, which is huge, especially for back then, because like what we're told is that God didn't care for the slaves. God cared for the kings and the pharaohs, right? And so these slaves are now telling the story of a God who cares for them and a God who hears their cries and is on the side of the oppressed. And then you get into Joshua and Judges once these slaves are freed and put into the promised land. And like what we see over and over again in the book of Judges is that the people who should be defined by the name of Yahweh are instead still living like the other cultures around them and oppressing the people in their midst and are treating them horribly and are not really listening to to the call of God to act justly. And then we get to this story, like this is like a very specific focused story of Hannah, who was a barren woman, and she was almost mistreated and despised, and even considered drunk, you know, early on in this story, and kind of crazy and on the margins. And then God blesses her and opens up her womb. And what happens is that a savior is raised up who redefines the religious system and that temple at Shiloh, right? Like, because yeah. the sons of Eli's, Hophni and Phinehas, who were they acting like? They were acting like Pharaoh, you know, like they were taking the meat that they wanted to eat. They were taking the women that they wanted to use for their pleasure without any care or concern for the people. And I'm pretty sure that they used their religion as a justification for what they were doing. And so they were acting like Pharaoh. And then this story is just like a straight up kind of, again, kind of saying like, no, you're misunderstanding. I am the God of the poor and of the oppressed. And my justice will liberate these people, not continue to oppress them. So, I mean, I think that's how I would say it, which I think goes really well with what you were talking about.
I've been looking at the text from the perspective of Eli, and along with what both of you are saying, I think it's interesting that there's nothing going on at Shiloh, and then this lady has a child, and Eli's blessing to the lady is, may you have more kids, as if that's the expectation of how God is going to act these days. Like, we don't know how God's going to act, and oh, this lady has a kid, that must be how God's going to act, so we're going to bless her in these ways. Which, Hannah has more kids, granted, but I was looking at it from the what to expect when you're expecting. Eli, you can tell Eli has no idea what to expect, and he's sort of glomming on to this, oh, well, maybe God is about having more babies for barren women. And we get the sense that he's completely missing out on what he ought to be expecting, which is clarified later. But at least for now, we kind of get the sense of Eli's trying to be this priest, but he's lost as to what God is doing in the world. He has no clue.
Right. And again, like, he's using his understanding of the pagan gods to influence his understanding of Yahweh. You know, like that Yahweh is just another fertility god who's in the business of just blessing families with more kids.
My way into the story for our people is going to be the act of gift giving and receiving, right? It's Sunday after Christmas. Many of these people will probably still have Christmas, like family Christmases that they haven't gotten to yet. Maybe even that evening, there's a lot of gift exchanging, and I want to talk about Hannah's gift of this robe to Samuel as like a continual reminder to Samuel that he represents a change to the status quo, right? Mm-hmm. It's like her constant presence with him, reminding him of that song that she taught him as a baby. You know,
yeah,
the song that she sung of the powerful being pulled down and the hungry being fed and all of this kind of stuff. And so then challenging our people, I'm stealing from Miroslav Volf here, his book Free of Charge, challenging our people to understand the gifts that they receive as invitations from God to enter into the divine life of giving and receiving. And that is the way by which we are a people that is against the status quo.
Yeah, I was trying to think of how to actually incorporate the whole idea of just a gift and responsibility. And I was trying to figure out how to do that in a way that people would understand, because my, like, the initial thought that I wanted to jump onto was Derrida's kind of excursus on the idea of gift or the economy of the gift. Have either of you guys heard that or read that?
I think the last time I heard about it was honestly from you, so I would appreciate a refresher.
So Derrida, when he talks about the economy of the gift, he says that there is actually no free gift given, because every time a gift is given, then there's an expected response, whether that be from like getting the person who gave you a gift, giving them a gift, or even acting and responding grateful. So he goes on this whole kind of idea that no, there's actually no free gift. Like no gift is ever actually a gift, because there's always to some degree in culture and society an expected response. And I was actually going to use that as a way to just to kind of talk about the whole idea, like the dichotomy between Samuel and Eli's sons, about how they were both kind of, they were both given this responsibility, and the Eli's sons chose a response that was actually not proper according to the gift that they've been given. And Samuel, as we continue to read in the book of Samuel's, that his response was actually the proper response according to the gift that he'd been given. And just kind of use that as the entry point into talking about the theme of this being a part of the larger story of Exodus, and how God gives us this gift of grace, but our response is like, there is a proper response to the gift that God has given us. And that's why it's been given to us. So that's what I was going to use.
Sheldon on The Big Bang Theory has multiple diatribes that would adequately explain Derrida's economy of the gift.
Does he really?
Oh, yeah, all the time. Because gift,
I need to start watching that show.
Yeah, for him, gifting is about you're gonna owe me something, or I'm gonna owe you something, and so I don't want to give or get gifts. It's great.
But in season two, I think it's in season two, there's a great deconstruction of Sheldon's position, and we've used this clip in sermons about gift giving before, where Penny. Because like Sheldon, every time someone gives him a gift, he calculates how much the gift costs so that he can give an appropriate gift in return. And Penny has threatened him that she has the perfect gift. And so he has bought three different sizes of Bed Bath & Beyond or Bath & Body Works gift bags. And his plan is, as soon as he receives Penny's gift, he's going to feign stomach problems, sneak off to his room, calculate how much it cost, and then give the appropriate gift in response. And what she gives him is a napkin from when Leonard Nimoy came into the Cheesecake Factory where she works, and it's a used napkin from Leonard Nimoy. And so Sheldon declares that there is no gift that is appropriately responsive, and so he gives her all of the gift baskets and then hugs her. And for Sheldon, that's like, you know, the biggest gift he can give is that she got a hug from him.
Right.
It's a really hilarious, but it's a fun way to poke at that idea.
Yeah. But again, there was a response. The gift that was given to him pushed him to the point where he had to give all that he had. So yeah. That's funny.
Chris, what are you guys doing?
I think where I'm headed with this text so far is again, I'm kind of caught up in this whole, these expectations of the ways we see God acting, and especially I doubt it'll be radically different by Christmas. Just the ways we're seeing Christians expect God to respond to the issues going on in culture, and I really see Eli as being. I mean, later on it says he was blind or his sight was failing. And this this idea that we kind of have, well, we think God's going to act in these ways, and so God must always act in these ways. And the reality is that in the text, God is beginning to act in new ways through this child, Samuel, and Eli doesn't see it. And I think then sort of connecting that to we as the church, are we looking and anticipating new ways God wants to act in the world, or are we just going, oh, God did that before, that must be how God has to act in the future, and are we blind? Which doesn't sound very Christmassy, but it will be, I promise.
That's fantastic. Well, we are about out of time this week. We would love to hear what you're planning to do with this text for Christmas. We would love to hear whether you're going rogue like Patrick and starting the next series, or whether you're going to stick with us old conservatives like Chris and me and keep going with what to expect when we're expecting. You can let us know at catchylecty.com in the show notes, or you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/catchylecty. Thanks again for listening and for the hard work that you're putting into your preaching endeavors. We wish you all the best. Merry Christmas, and may grace and peace be with you. So I would appreciate a refresher. Anyone still there?
There is no refresher, apparently.
Edric? Patrick, we lost you.
I know.
Oh, there you are. Back. You're back.